The following message was recorded at the 2015 Building Tomorrow's Church Conference in Flagstaff, Arizona. This is the Defense of Our Faith with Dr. James White.
Well, it's so, even loud enough to wake all of us up on a Sunday afternoon. I hope maybe some of you got your Baptin app. That is a requirement that I'll let Dr. Renahan lecture on this element of it, but there was a tremendous dispute over the inclusion of the Baptin app in the 1689. It's a very, very rarely known incident in our history. It almost made it in, didn't it? It was really close. It was a very close vote on the Baptin app. But some of us, despite the fact that it didn't quite make it in, still believe that it's almost confessional to be able to fall asleep. I think it's genetic, personally, I was born a Baptist, and therefore on Sunday afternoons I fall asleep. So that's just sort of how that works. But hopefully you won't do that. You've already had your chance to do that, and I won't cause you to lose consciousness over the next few moments that we have together. I do want to direct your attention to 1 Peter chapter 3. Once again, leadership provided some, I think they probably just figured these might be suggestions or something along those lines as to where we might want to go. I sort of took them a little bit more than suggestions, and 1 Peter 3:15 is certainly what is called the Classicus Locus, the classical text on the subject of apologetics. And I know from the time that I learned what apologetics was that many times, even in my younger years, as I was just first beginning to do work in that area, when I would be asked to speak in a small group or maybe even at a church once in a while back in those days, I would certainly go to this text and a number of others and talk about the need to defend the faith, a need to know the faith well enough to provide a defense for it. But I'll be perfectly honest with you, it was not until just literally about 5 or 6 years ago now that I really wrestled with this text and started to realize not only how important it is, but what it is really stating, what it's really saying to us. And it does illustrate the fact that there are a lot of texts that we have heard cited so many times that we just hear it, we automatically accept that, and we move on. And sometimes that's dangerous. Sometimes that's dangerous. For example, how many times have you heard someone talking about the I am sayings of Jesus, for example, in the Gospel of John? The I am sayings of Jesus, John 8:24, 8:58, 13:19, and 18:5-6 in the Gospel of John. And someone will especially look at primarily John 8:58, before Abraham was, I am. And you'll even find study Bibles, for example, just in passing. I've never understood the concept of a study Bible. Now, don't get me wrong. Just to give you my cred here, I was not raised as a Reformed Baptist. And the first Bible I read all the way through, I'm not sure if I should say this in public. We are recording this, aren't we? I think we are. You're going to guess? Sure. Wow. Let me tell you something. I've been in mosques. I've been in Catholic churches. I've never taken a shot like that. Wow, that's the Living Bible. No, I said Bible. That was, and I would pretty much say the same thing about the New Living Translation, because it's not a translation. Okay, just so you know, I don't know if anyone has one out there, but don't tell me if you do. No. It was, of course, the New Scofield Reference Bible. What else would a self-respecting fundamentalist read? And I've never understood the concept, though, of the study Bible. It became so popular, and they're still popular. I mean, my daughter was frothing at the mouth about the new Reformation study Bible, and I bought one for her and sent it to her, and all of her says, "That thing is that thick. I don't even know how you bind something like that." And and I mean, if you carried that always in one arm, you'd have one big, huge arm. One little arm, it'd be just really weird. It's just, I just sort of figure if you want a commentary, buy a commentary. Just you know, it's a separate volume. You don't have to carry it all the time because you don't always need it. I've never gotten the study Bible thing since it became, especially once you had the left-handed, blue-eyed person study Bible type thing. You know, it just got a little bit excessive for me. But anyway, how did I get on study Bible? So what was the process of that? I'm completely lost. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Someone's short-term memory. Well, that's sort of medium-term memory by that point. So that's a little bit better. But I remember talking to someone who actually was involved in writing the study notes for a very well-known study Bible in a situation once. And in John 8:58, where it talked about the I Am sayings of Jesus, it directed you to go straight back to Exodus 3:14 and the burning bush where God appears to Moses, of course, and he says, "I am that I am." Well, that's dangerous. It's absolutely dangerous. If you run into a sharp Jehovah's Witness, let me tell you something. There are some very sharp Jehovah's Witnesses out there. There's a whole band of merry internet Unitarians running around out there that, that's all they do. That's all they ever study, and they can take on the best we have. Just now, they can't deal with anything else in the Christian faith, but that one area, man, they've got it all down. They will take you apart if you try to go, "Well, you know, Jesus said before Abraham was, I am," and you have the I am in Exodus 3:14. They'll go, "Excuse me, but in Exodus 3:14, it's ego I me ha own. I am the one being. The one being is not. It's not ego I me. It's ha own." And if you don't realize that the actual connection between the I Am sayings and John goes through Isaiah and some of the minor prophets, where ego I Me is used over and over again, even as a euphemism for the name of Yahweh, if you don't make that stop before you get back to Exodus 3, the sharp folks will take you apart. And so I'm illustrating the fact that there are texts, you can just hear them used so many times, that we don't really think through them, and it can be dangerous. I was thinking, Brother Renahan was speaking yesterday about 1 Corinthians 8, 6, and 7. And what we have there is a section, a portion of a confession of faith in the church, and it takes us back to the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad. And Paul expands upon the Shema, to where he uses the word God for the Father and the term that is rendered as Yahweh, Kurios in Greek, of the Son. And it's fascinating. But I hadn't mentioned to him, I was just about to be writing an article on that because the Unitarians have decided that that's not the source of 1 Corinthians 8. It's actually Malachi 2:10, and they're putting out their arguments and all the rest of this stuff. Point being that sometimes we'll hear these things, and we need to be aware of what the text is really saying, even though we may have heard the same thing over and over and over again. Sometimes that ruins some really neat sermons. Now, we sang a song. I didn't say anything about it. But we sang a song yesterday, and it was, you seemingly indicated it was a new one. And I was listening to it, and I was just sitting there going, "Well, it's so pretty. And it's wonderful, but man, I couldn't defend this theology for the life of me." And you go, "What do you mean?" Well, just in passing, let me just throw something out for you all to think about. But how many times have you heard somebody quote the text when Jesus is on the cross, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," my God, why have you forsaken me?" And then they go, "This is when the Father turned his back upon the Son." I don't believe that for a second. I don't. If there was actually a fundamental disruption between the Father and the Son, at the very point of the Son's ultimate obedience to the Father. Right before Jesus says that and right after Jesus says that, he uses the second person and direct address to the Father. Into thy hands I commit my spirit. Man, if there had been a fundamental disruption of the Godhead and a turning of the back and all the rest of this stuff, I think the author of the Hebrews would have said something about it. To me, this is the very point of Jesus' absolute perfect obedience to the Father. And that's not what he was doing when he said, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Those are the very first words of Psalm 22. And what is Psalm 22? It is a messianic psalm. Listen to all the psalm. Yes, it begins there, but how does it end? With the vindication of the suffering servant. And he is simply quoting, it'd be like us saying, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. Do I have to quote the rest of the song for you? Or this morning, how many of you actually held your song sheet while singing A Mighty Fortress? Excuse me, if you're Reformed, you don't need a hymnal or a song sheet to sing A Mighty Fortress. I was looking around going, what are you people doing? I mean, that's how you show your street cred is, you know, I mean, if you're a Calvinist, you just, you know, turn to hymn number, which number is it in the Trinity hymnal? 81, that's right. See? And when you hear someone say, turn to hymn number 81, if you want to prove that you're a Calvinist, you put the hymnal back in the back of the pew. You got me started on this. When you hit me with the Living Bible, everything fell apart, okay? It was just like, all over with. But all of that as introduction to take us back to 1 Peter 3:15. And my admission that after years and years of being an apologist, I finally came to recognize really what 1 Peter 3:15 was saying. It's not that I had been misrepresenting, it was that I was not representing it in its fullness. Yes, it says sanctify. Now it's an awkward construction. It's an awkward construction because it's literally, let me give you just a literal rendering of the Greek. Lord, kurion, the Christ, sanctify in your hearts. Always being ready, pros apologion, toward a reasoned defense, always toward a reasoned defense to everyone asking you a reason concerning the in you hope. Okay, there's your absolutely mishmashed, completely out of English word order, literal rendering of the original text. But how many of you have a translation? And I think, I didn't look at the New American Standard, but I'm still the old New American Standard type guy because I like the fact that it puts Old Testament citations in block. The problem is you can't use that electronically because it looks like you're screaming at someone, you know, because it ends up in all capital letters. Like it's like a King James only website, you know. What? Haven't... Look, I am the expert on King James only websites because I am Satan incarnate according to all of the King James only websites. So I know all of them. And to prove a point on a King James only website, you use blink, the old HTML, it flashes, you underline it, put it in block quotations and make it red. That proves the point. I mean, that's all there is to it. So that's the problem with using all block quotes from the Old Testament on your blog or whatever else. It looks like you're screaming at somebody. But what I really like is that it lets you see what the Old Testament citations are. So are there any translations out there where the word Lord in 3:15 is indicated as being a part of an Old Testament citation? Does anybody have one that has that? Because it is. And that's one of the keys to understanding the background of this text. Look back, look at the context, and see what Peter's talking about. He's talking to Christians. We're going to be suffering in this world, and we're going to experience resistance and so on and so forth. And he says in verse 14, but you know, if you're going to suffer because of righteousness, blessed are you. And then hopefully most of our translations will indicate that the rest of this verse is a direct quotation from the Old Testament, right? It does give that indication. If it doesn't, you need a different translation, English translation. Because it says, but the fear of them you do not fear, neither be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. And what you don't see is that the term Lord and sanctify are part of the Old Testament citation. They're part of the Old Testament citation. Now, where is this coming from? Well, there are a couple places. We could look at Isaiah 29:23. I don't have time to do that. But I would like to look at, have you look with me at Isaiah chapter 8. Now, if you've got references, you've hopefully already saw that there is a link there to take you back to Isaiah chapter 8, beginning in verse 6. And if you have time sometime, I would recommend to you a close reading of Isaiah 8 through 11, especially looking at the phrase Emmanuel, God with us. Fascinating section, because many of the New Testament writers draw from this section and make application in their letters, and Peter's certainly doing this here. Listen to this section in Isaiah chapter 8, beginning at verse 6. Inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria in all his glory, and it will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. So this is a judgment section. Because of the rebellion of the people, then the Lord's going to bring the Assyrians upon them. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land. And then what's the next phrase? O Emmanuel. O Emmanuel. Now, we all know what Emmanuel means. It means God with us. But here it's being used as a title. O Emmanuel. But keep that in mind, because then it goes on to say, be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand. For, and what's odd is, here the New American Standard, instead of saying, O Emmanuel, says, God is with us. But that was the same phrase that was used before. It's the exact same thing in the Hebrew language. For Emmanuel, God is with us. For thus, Yahweh, and I hope we all recognize LRD in all caps is the tetragrammaton, the four-letter covenant name of God. For thus, Yahweh spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy in regard to all this that this people call a conspiracy. And then listen. And you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. That's what you have in 1 Peter 3:14. It is Yahweh of hosts whom you should regard as holy. It is Yahweh of hosts whom you should regard as holy. So in the original text of Isaiah chapter 8, you have this discussion. And remember what we had in Isaiah 7. Remember Isaiah 7:14? There is Emmanuel found there. All the way through chapter 11, you're going to find significant uses of this phrase, Emmanuel. And then right here, Peter decides to draw from the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And he says, you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it, but it is Yahweh of hosts whom you are to regard as holy. Now compare what Peter then does with that. As Kurios, the Christ, the Messiah, you are to regard as holy in your hearts. So here, just as we have in the expanded fulfillment of the Shema in 1 Corinthians 8:6, now we have the apostolic expansion of this Old Testament passage with application to the Messiah. And so we are told that we are to set apart as holy, to consider as holy in our hearts, Kurion, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. They did not put the Hebrew tetragrammaton in. They didn't put Yahweh in. Instead, they rendered that by the term kurios, or Lord. And so that's why that Lord and sanctify, if we had some way of showing it, and the American Standard should be all blocks or italics or however else we're doing it, those words are coming directly out of the Greek Septuagint. And Peter intends his audience to know this and to recognize that what he's doing is he's taking a command that was given to the people in Isaiah chapter 8, and it's still an abiding command now, but it's even more understandable because there's been this revelation that God has made of himself. And what he's saying is that we should sanctify Yahweh. But then what does he do? He has kurion, which is in the accusative, and ton Christon, which is in the accusative. We are to sanctify Christ as kurios, as Yahweh. This is one of those many texts that we have in the New Testament where the New Testament writers take Old Testament texts that were specifically about the covenant God of Israel, Yahweh himself, and they apply that to Jesus in a way that simply could not be applied to any representative of Yahweh or anything else. That's the way that, by the way, Unitarians get around this. This group of internet Unitarians that are out there, the way they try to get around the testimony to Jesus as Yahweh is that, well, Jesus is the representative of Yahweh. But that doesn't work, for example, in Hebrews chapter 1, where Jesus is described as being immutable, the immutable, unchanging creator of all things. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 12, quoting from Psalm 102, 25 to 27. And it doesn't work here either, because what we are being commanded to do is in the very center of our existence, in our hearts, we are to consider, we are to set apart the Messiah as kurios in that sense of holiness. The term is hagiadzo. The root in the original language is saints. That which is hagios is holy. And so we are to treat as holy Christ as kurios in the very center of our being. That is the expanded, fulfilled understanding that the Apostle Peter provides for us here at the beginning of 1 Peter 3:15. Now, this is what I was missing for all of those years, because it's natural for the mind to go directly to always ready to give a defense. But you see, and this is very important, in the text itself, there is something we must do before that is foundational to being ready to give a defense to those who ask us a reason for the hope that's within us. And I'm afraid that I will have to admit that many people who become enamored with the idea of apologetics, and I especially understand, there are young men who get excited about the idea of apologetics. I was a young man when I first started doing apologetics, and so I have to be careful what I say here. But there are many times young men will come up to me after a debate. They will, there's someone here. Who was the fellow that was here that mentioned that you attended the debate I did just a few weeks ago with the imam in Southern California? There we go. There he is. You're not that young, but you know what I mean. Has anybody else attended? Well, I know Brother Renahan has attended a couple of my debates, participated in a couple of my debates. Anyone else attend any of the debates that I've done down through the years? There's just a couple folks. Okay. How about seeing some of them on YouTube? There we go. Okay, there you go. Sometimes people will come up to me after a debate, and they're all excited. And they go, I want to get involved in apologetics. I want to become an apologist. What should I do? And I'll be perfectly honest with you. Pastorally, I throw a bucket of ice water on their head. I really do. I basically say, do you have gifts in doing anything else? Well, if you do, I'd suggest you do it. And they're like, huh? First of all, I figure if I can dissuade them, then they don't need to be doing that anyways. So if my bucket of ice water is enough, then I save them from some real problems. But my real concern is that they didn't see the years and years and years and years of preparation that went into that debate. They did not see those years when Alpha and Omega Ministries was a tiny little bit of nothing. They didn't see the times that I would spend hours preparing a seminar. I remember once I did a seminar on the New World Translation of Jehovah's Witnesses. And I had handouts, and I was ready to go to town. And I went into the little conference room that we rented from the office complex where we had our little teeny office. And it was supposed to start at 7 o'clock, and there I sat. 7:05, 7:10. About 7:15, I put all those handouts back together again and took them back to the office and locked the door and went home because there wasn't anybody there, wasn't anybody to talk to. And they don't see that. They don't see the number of times that happened, or there was one person or two people, and the wife working so that you can do those things and go to. They don't see all of that. And so I sort of try to introduce them to reality. It can be exciting to do. There's no question about that. But there's a lot more that goes into it than meets the eye. And sadly, a lot of apologists I know of are not churchmen. They just travel about doing their things. They're not really associated with the church, and that's a problem. Before you do the apologetics, and that's the very term, prosopologion, that's the only place it's found. In the sense of this sense, that we've mentioned it earlier in Romans chapter 1. They're without an apologia in Romans chapter 1. But as far as a commandment to Christians, it's right there, but there's something we must do first. And I'm afraid that it's something that we're very rarely challenged to do to the depth that very clearly this text would require us to do it. It is for all Christians, by the way. This is not limited to the elders of the church. This is obviously everything Peter's saying here is to all Christians. They're all going to suffer the slings and arrows of the world and the resistance of the world. And so this is something we are all commanded to do. And if it's a commandment, we might want to know how to fulfill it. But let's think about what it's saying. First of all, it takes place in the heart. It takes place in the very center point of our being. This is not impersonal. This does not leave aside the intellectual. But it includes the entirety of our being. It is the very heart and soul of the center of our personhood. And so it involves our emotions, it involves our affections, it involves our mind, it involves our intellect. In our hearts, we are to do something. And what are we to do? Well, it's this idea of treating something as holy. Setting something apart, the very root meaning of hagiadzo, the very root meaning of sanctify or treat as holy, is to consider something to be special, to set it apart. It's not profane. It is not just a daily use thing. When we think of Isaiah 6 and God upon his throne and the angels are saying, holy, 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 when we think of that holiness, yes, very often we think of holiness in the sense of righteousness and purity, and all those things are a part of it. But at its root, it means completely other. Other than profane, other than normal, unique. And so to treat something as holy in our hearts is to give it a special place, a central place, not a profane place. And that is why we cannot, if we are serious believers in Jesus Christ, approach Christianity as if it is a part of our life. We have our secular life. We have our sports life. We have our religious life. And unfortunately, that's what I think a large portion of what calls itself evangelicalism in our world today is all about. As I said, if 60% of the people in this land are actually truly believers, it would have a huge impact upon what happens in this land. But the reason you can fill former Houston Rockets basketball arenas with people who come to hear fluff is because in their thinking, Christianity is one portion. It's one little section that you can fit into a Sunday morning, and maybe if you're feeling particularly religious, a Sunday night, but that doesn't really necessarily have a huge impact upon Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, upon the rest of your life. That is not an option for the person who is desirous of obeying the command that is found here in 1 Peter 3:15. This idea of treating as holy Christ as Lord in your hearts means that you are setting this truth and this one apart in such a way that this holiness is reflective of the attitude you have toward this one. And who is this one? The Messiah as Yahweh. So in other words, this becomes an ordering principle. If you set him apart, if you recognize that the Messiah truly was the incarnate one, that the second person of the Trinity has entered into his own creation, that he has provided perfect redemption upon the cross of Calvary, that you have in the New Testament documents, the Father identified as Yahweh, the Son is identified as Yahweh, the Spirit is the Spirit of Yahweh. Yahweh therefore becomes a word that refers to the very being of God. There's not a confusion of the persons. We're not saying that Jesus is the Father or anything like that at all. But that this refers to the being of God and that Jesus Christ truly was God in human flesh. If you believe that, and if you make that each and every day an ordering principle of your life, that you are his servant, that he's truly entered into this world, he's coming again, he has given you his word, that is going to reorder all of your principles in your life, all your priorities. It's going to become that which gives order to every aspect of your life. Very often young people will say, well, I want to find God's will for your life. Well, start here. Set apart Christ as Lord, as Yahweh, in your hearts each and every day. Begin with that, and that will order everything else. That will order everything else. So that's what we are commanded to do. It is not an option. And it is the very thing, my friends, that once again, the world around us wants to convince us to never do. Because if you do this, then you will not do what they desire you to do, and that is to join the crowd in bowing the knee to Caesar, bowing the knee to the world, bowing the knee to your fleshly desires, bowing the knee to the love of the things of this world. How many of you saw the graphic that I referred to on Facebook this morning? I actually made it my background image on my Facebook page. I just found out right before I came over here, someone sent me a tweet that had the historical background of this picture. I'd never seen it before in my life. But it's a picture from 1936. And there's a whole group of Germans, and they're all doing their Sieg Heil. But someone's put a circle, and there's one guy. One guy in the whole group, everybody's got their arm out, and there's one guy. Just like this. Everybody else behind him, next to him, in front of him, they're all doing the Sieg Heil, and he's like this. Won't do it. And it's clearly purposeful. And I've discovered we know who he is, and we know why he did it. Unfortunately, he died in the war. He was unwillingly drafted in and ended up dying in the Russian front. In Crimea someplace, I believe. But he detested the Nazis because, I didn't get finished reading the whole story, but I think it was because they would not allow him to marry the woman that he desired to marry because she was not pure enough. And he realized this is a mess. And so there he stands, and he goes against everybody. Now that was dangerous. That was dangerous. How many of you have actually read 1984? Okay. It's not a Christian book, but I'm recommending it to everybody. Because if you want to know what's going on around you, somehow somebody knew. Long time ago, 1949, actually, I believe is when it was written. And there's a scene in there where they would have everybody get together and they would scream their hatred at this one image that was the enemy of the state. And then Big Brother would come up and there would be this... Oh, this love of Big Brother. You had to be so careful that you screamed properly and that you showed enough hatred and anger toward the traitor and then showed enough love toward Big Brother, because if you weren't quite passionate enough, if you weren't quite into it that day, you could disappear that night. So it's dangerous to go against the flow. And there was that guy going against the flow. This says you and I we've got to go against the flow. Because the world will not, the world sanctifies itself. The world wants you to put love of things and love of money and love of the passing things of this world. That's what you're to sanctify in your heart. That's what you're to set apart, because that's what the world does. Because that's all the world has. They have no transcendent meaning to be able to look toward. And so the world wants you to do what they're doing, because what does Romans 1 tell us? People know that people that practice these things deserve death, but not only do they do them, but they do what? They encourage other people to do the same thing. Sin loves company. And you bring conviction and condemnation to the world when you refuse to walk in the way that the world would demand that you walk. And so if you sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, it's going to prioritize everything, and it's going to change you, and it's going to change how you respond to what happens around you. Because did you notice something? We are to always be ready to give a reasoned defense. That's what an apologia is. To whom? Now, I had noticed this before I really started working with this text, but I really hadn't sort of followed through with it. You see, for most apologists, it's be ready to give a defense to everyone that you tackle on the street and hold down, get a back mount on them, put them in a chokehold, and explain to them your great brilliance in understanding the Christian faith. That's not what it says. It's to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. Now, think about that for a moment. Think about that for a moment. I sort of have to talk to my own apologetics community. How many people would come to me and ask me for a reason for the hope that's in me? Would they see that I have a hope within me? You see, the first application here is the people who are in your immediate circle, your family, your friends, the people in your community, because there's something about you that causes them to go, hey, something tragic just happened, but you're not responding like everybody else does. You don't respond to death the way the rest of us do. You don't have hopelessness. You don't seem to be in love with things the way the rest of us are. You've suffered a loss. Maybe you lost a job, or you've suffered a physical loss to where you've lost some capacity or ability. You don't respond the way that other people do. Why? You see, the assumption of the text is that you've obeyed the command to sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. You've set up that proper godly list of priorities with His Lordship at the top, which then provides all that you need to put the rest in the proper order, and that will inevitably have an impact on how you speak, how you think, how you respond, and how you interact with others around you. Now, it's not going to make us a bunch of clones of each other. We are not clones. God has not called us to be clones of one another. I'm thankful that's the case. I enjoy the wide variety of the body of Christ. And there are some of you that are just so much more naturally gregarious than I am. I am a Scotsman. Have you ever watched Braveheart? Okay, I have a William Wallace sword on my desk. I really do. I love it. But Scotsmen, we're not Italians. We are not Italians. Now, when I first started going to New York and ministering in churches in New York, there are a lot of Italians in the churches in New York. And what do Italians do? Hey! And I'm like, back off. Personal space, please. Please stop. Please. I mean, I am really uncomfortable when someone tries to hug me. We wear kilts, for crying out loud. There's a reason here. And so I loved when I first got a chance to go to Scotland. Oh, my goodness. I was amongst my own. And it was so great. We had such wonderful fellowship. This is how a Scotsman hugs. Ready? I'm gonna hug Brother Renahan. What? Did you catch that? You caught it. He caught it. He's good with it. That was good. That's my kind of expression of deep emotion and feeling. That doesn't mean that I don't have deep emotion and feeling. We just don't really think it's necessary to express it to everybody all around us, especially when there's cameras in the audience, okay? So I'm not saying, and if you're Italian, please don't wear a kilt. We copyrighted it, trademarked it. It's not yours. Leave it alone, okay? And if you need to keep hugging each other, it's okay. It's all right. We think it's weird, but it's okay. It's all right. No problem. We're not clones of one another. And so some people are called to you might be able to reach people that I can't reach. I can reach some people that you can't reach. It's sometimes an advantage to be Scottish when you're involved in apologetics. You know, people say, how did you put up with that? I mean, that guy was just so mean and nasty. Yeah, an Italian would have gotten up and socked him in the nose. The Scotsman's just going, you want some more rope? You want some more rope? Go ahead, keep going. You know, it works. It's perfect. It's perfect. So different kind of people are going to be the ones that are going to be observing me, and they're going to be asking me in different ways. But still, there are those Christian characteristics that we all must have, and they are going to ask about the hope that we have. The hope that we have. I learned a long time ago. Is that thing right? Oh, man. Okay. All right. We pick up the pace here. I learned a long time ago, God put me in the toughest position to grow me up. Years and years ago, we lost 60% of our tiny, small amount of funding of our ministry in one day. And I had to immediately find, you know, I had to be a tent maker immediately just to keep things going, just to keep the family afloat, so on and so forth. And what the Lord did is in an absolutely supernatural way, because, I mean, I could not even explain how this happened. I ended up as one of the staff chaplains at a major hospital in the Phoenix area. Now, again, as a Scotsman, walking into the sick room of someone you've never met before in your life and trying to get to know them and seeing if there's something you can do to minister to them, that was tough. That was some of the hardest work I ever did in my life. Really, really, really was. And what made it really hard was on Sunday afternoons, it was a secular hospital, and on Sunday afternoons there was a loss support group. And every other week, I was supposed to be the one that led that. Well, the other chaplain was candidating for churches to find a new position. And so in the first 52 weeks, I did 49 of the lost support groups. Wasn't quite an even split. And man, I learned a lot. That was so hard. Oh, that was so hard. But what I discovered, the hospital is fairly close to a retirement area. And so most of the people in that group were widows who had just lost the husband that they had had for 40, 50 years of their life. And one of the things I discovered was that if that woman, if I could not help her and her family could not help her to be able to look to the future with something called hope, that the future wasn't just going to be this big black wall, but that there would be a reason to continue on, there would be light, there would be happiness, there would be purpose. The one word was hope. If that woman could not have that hope, she wouldn't live. Literally would not live. I mean, we saw women, healthy when he died, dead in a year because they had no hope. They had no hope. Hope was the key to whether you were going in an upward spiral of working through your grief or going into the downward spiral of depression, and then the body falls apart and hopelessness. And it was all about the word hope. And that is a very strong Christian theme in the New Testament, is that we have a hope, the hope that is within us that is focused upon Jesus Christ. And so that hope is what we're going to be asked about. And the reason we're going to be asked about it is because we have set aside Christ as Lord in our hearts. That has prioritized everything, that gives us direction, that gives us shape, that gives us form. It influences how we react to everything, how we speak. And so the reality is the command to prosopologion, to give that reasoned defense, is in the middle of this holistic, whole life commandment that really is simply a reflection of Christ being formed within us. And that's why every time someone takes that and they go running with it, and you know, some of you back when you were just scrawny kids, when I knew you, when you were scrawny kids, worked with us in passing out tracts to the Mormons, and maybe even went up to Salt Lake City with us a couple times, things like that. And one of the things that I would say back in those olden days when we were preparing people is I'd say, I would rather have 5 people go with me that know the gospel, know who Jesus is, can explain what the gospel is, than 50 people that can rip and shred Joseph Smith but have nothing positive to give to the Mormon people. And the attitude of people, they watch a movie, they watch The Godmakers, and they get out their theological sword, and they just want to go get the thing bloody. They cannot point to this text and say, well, it says I'm to give a defense, because that's missing the whole reason. The reason why we should be prepared to give a reasoned defense. That means we do need to think through our faith. That means, you know, I haven't been wasting my life all of these years to try to help other people to understand how we can give a reasoned defense of the faith and how we need to know about the Trinity and the deity of Christ and the sufficiency of Scripture and what atonement means and justification by faith and all the rest of that stuff. I haven't been wasting my time, but you see, that doesn't exist unto itself. That's the content of the truth, but when Peter makes this command, when Peter directs this command to us, he does it in such a way that he will not create imbalanced people that are jumping on their white horses and heading off into disaster, which I've seen so many times. I've seen so many times people that they weren't a part of the church, they didn't have their foundations right, they weren't balanced, they hadn't really set Christ as Lord apart in their heart. And they ended up getting sucked into all sorts of kinds of error, or even worse, becoming so harsh and divisive that they end up causing problems in every single church they're a part of. I can think of one apologist. I won't name him. But I think of one apologist. I don't believe that man has been in the same church for more than 3 years at any point in his life until he split it. And man, he's going to have to answer for that. That's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. And it clearly shows there's something wrong with that man's spirituality, that he would be so divisive and so incapable of getting along with someone who's a little bit different that you end up causing division after division after division after division. When you look at this text, you discover it has the highest view of Christ. It's one of those passages that identify Jesus as Yahweh. But then it takes that high divine truth and it makes it something that's relevant to you every single day. See, sometimes people say, well, you know, Christianity is a little weird because you've got all these doctrines up here. You've got the Trinity and all this stuff. And it just seems so separate from everyday life. I can't see how that stuff is supposed to matter in my everyday life. Well, here you go. Here you've got Peter, the Galilean fisherman, saying to you, set the Messiah as Yahweh apart in a holy fashion in the very center of your being. And as a result of that, always be ready to give a reasoned defense. Know your faith to anyone who asks you a reason with hopes within you, because you've set Christ apart, and people are going to come to you and say, why are you different? Why are you different? And so, does the text say what I had said all those years about the need for apologetics and being ready? Yes, it does say all that. But it's really the subservient point. It's the secondary point. It's there. It's important. But to do it properly, to do it in a way that is glorifying to God, requires hearing the whole thing. And I think Peter's original audience would have heard that, because they would have heard the echoes of that text from Isaiah 8. And they would have known where that was being drawn from. And so they would have seen that that was about Yahweh. And now Peter's applying it to the very one he walked with along the shore of the Sea of Galilee. What an amazing thing that is. And then they would have understood. He's saying we need to treat him as holy. And then that's going to have this impact in our lives that will then give us a meaningful foundation for giving testimony to the faith. So there is the classical text. And does it teach the importance of apologetics? Yes, but first it teaches the importance of a balanced understanding and a recognition that each and every day, my friends, each and every day, the world is going to try to steal the commandment of this text from your thinking. Every day, the world wants you to bow the knee to it, not to Christ. And so in some pretty inventive ways, sometimes in religious ways, sometimes in ways that start off godly or are a matter of indifference, adiaphora, but the world's going to find a way to try to get you to forget what I just said to you, that every single day as a believer, we set the Messiah as Yahweh apart in our hearts in holiness and say, I want to live in light of who he is. He is to give priority to everything else in my life. I do not want to follow the world. I reject the lordship of the world. I embrace the lordship of the Messiah, and I want to live in light of his truth and his will for my life. That will change all of us, and the world will notice it. The world will notice it. But remember, the world will do everything it can to cause you to forget this. In fact, you want a way to prove it? Want a geeky way to prove it? Take your smartphone, use your calendar app, put a reminder for a month from now. Sometime during the day, just have it pop up and put something in there like, Lordship of Christ today? Have you forgotten? And have it pop up a month from now, or 31 days, 33 days, whatever. Something you won't even remember it until all of a sudden that it pops up on your phone, you go. And then think back. How many tricks has the world used to get you to forget about that? Might be an interesting experiment. There might be only two people in here to do it. But I challenge you. Try it. See what happens. Let's pray together. Our Heavenly Father, we as your people desire to be obedient to you. You have given us this command, but we are dependent upon your Spirit for the application, for the understanding, for the remembrance. Lord, teach us what it means to treat the Messiah as Lord in our hearts, to sanctify, set apart as holy, who he is, what he's accomplished, his truth, so that we might be ready to give a reasoned defense to everyone who asks us. Lord, we know that we've been called to this time, that we are to be used as light in the darkness. May that light come from the fact that it shines most brightly within our own hearts. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Building Tomorrow's Church, a conference ministry of Grace Covenant Church in Gilbert, Arizona. For more information about BTC, visit buildingtomorrowschurch.com. Thanks for listening, and may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you.